Hi, and welcome back to Undisclosed, our weekly unfiltered episode. Rabia here, and I'm here as always with my colleagues, Mithil and Colin. Hi, guys.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you guys doing?
Not bad.
Knee deep in 80 evidence exams, so.
Ooh. Is your semester over now, Colin?
The semester is officially over because I gave my evidence exam yesterday, and so now it's just all down to the grading.
Okay, let me ask you, are you actually manually grading every single exam?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, I mean, good. Good on you.
I told the students they can't use AI. I'm not going to use AI to grade it.
Good on you. Do you have the summer off, or are you teaching in the summer too?
I just have a research project and undisclosed work.
And you're going to write a million briefs and do all kinds of things we never learn about for 2 years later. Yeah.
I did just finish the draft of the reply in the Amanda Lewis case, and so we're going to file that by the end of the week.
Oh, nice. That's exciting.
Awesome.
Good. Maybe you can update us on what's going on once that's in. Mithil, what's up with you? How's your week gone?
It's gone okay. Had a nice weekend with family that was in town that I hadn't seen in many years.
Lies.
So it was a good catch up. It was a good
family
catch up.
Was around. It's lies. Shut up, Mithil. I know you too well. All right. We've got three stories we want to talk about this week. I'm going to start off this week with Colin. Colin, why don't you give us your evidence exam this week, as we get every week. Let's start off there.
All right. So probably the most confusing subject I teach to my students, and it's something that has increased relevance in 2026, is jury nullification, right? And so jury nullification is the inherent power that a jury has to render a verdict that is inconsistent with the evidence. Namely, you have someone with glaucoma in a state where marijuana, even medical marijuana, is illegal. They're caught with marijuana, they're prosecuted, and the jury believes it's an unjust law. Even though the evidence points towards guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, the jury has this power to nullify and to find the defendant not guilty. But this idea of jury nullification has a really tenuous position in the U.S. justice system, where the attorneys aren't allowed to tell jurors that they have the power to nullify. If the jurors ask the judge, can we nullify, the judge is allowed to tell them, if the evidence points towards guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, you have to find the defendant guilty. And so all this sets the stage for 2026, because in D.C. over the past year or so, there's been a number of cases in which the jury has found defendants not guilty despite the evidence pointing towards guilt. Probably the most infamous is the guy who chucked the sandwich at the customs officer and was prosecuted, and the jury found him not guilty. And so in response to these cases, there is this representative in Louisiana, Julia Letlow, and she has introduced the No Rogue Jurors Act. And what it notes is there's a number of organizations in D.C. that are teaching people who are prospective jurors about the power of nullification. And this act, if it passes, would deny federal funding to any organization that teaches about the power to nullify.
Wow.
And it's interesting because this isn't something that is solely based upon party lines. I tweeted a number of years ago about an effort in Tennessee by a Tennessee Republican, like the representative for this federal act, and he actually proposed legislation to require a jury instruction on nullification. It said, if you have reasonable doubt as to whether the state has proven any one or more of the elements of the crime charged, you must find the defendant not guilty. However, if you find the state has proven all the elements of the offense charged beyond a reasonable doubt, you should find the defendant guilty. And then the key language here, even if you find the state has proven all the elements of the offense charged beyond a reasonable doubt, you may still find that based upon the facts of this case, a guilty verdict would yield an unjust result, and you might find the defendant not guilty, right? And so as we have increased politicization and the possibility of defendants having jurors nullify, the question is, what do we do? Do we keep this sort of current tenuous position? Do we ban it? Do we actually authorize or mandate judges to give instructions? And if we go historically, right, in the time of the Fugitive Slave Act and the Underground Railroad, many jurors nullified, and people thought that was a great result. We're nullifying an unjust law.
Right.
We also had tons of lynchings in the South in the pre-Civil War era, the Reconstruction era. And we had many jurors nullifying and finding the defendants not guilty. And that was a terrible result, according to people who looked at this.
Sure.
And so there's the power for good and the power for bad. And so my question to the two of you is, you know, what do we do with nullification? Should this be part of a high school or college curriculum? Should there be organizations teaching it? Should it be banned? Should judges be forced to tell jurors they can nullify? Like, what do we do with these cases going forward with nullification?
First of all, I think it's odd. I think it's odd to try to legislate organizations from teaching it, because I have never been, I guess I learned about it in law school, but what civilian who's not a lawyer is being taught during nullification unless they end up on a jury and it's part of an instruction? I think most people don't even know what it is. So, I mean, I guess at first I'm a little bit confused by that. Like, what kind of, are they talking about specifically law schools or?
These were organizations in D.C., and they named a few of them that were doing this.
And they were doing this how? Like, just to the general public? They got, like, billboards? What are they – how are they educating people, and why? I'm trying to understand what the background here. I don't understand the point of legislation.
Some of the ones they named were Community Change Action, Center for Community Change and Community Change Action. And so, like, they would have basically seminars. In the D.C. area, learn about your rights. And people would come and they would learn about the power of nullification in D.C.
So the audience is random?
What's that?
The audience is random then in those cases?
Well, I mean, I assume these organizations...
Local communities,
Yeah, I mean, they're probably... They're groups that probably teach various things about civility.
Yeah. And obviously this is going to be in response to probably like the issues they've had with policing, these communities are having with policing anyways. First of all, there's that question. Do you think that, I mean, like, isn't this a First Amendment issue, though?
It could be. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's the power of the purse, and the argument would be we are entitled to deprive funding to organizations who teach what we don't like. But there is, I think, a First Amendment argument to be made, for sure.
But the ultimate question about whether it should be banned or allowed, I think you complicated it for us with that very clear example of folks being tried for lynching versus, you know, runaway slaves. I hate it when you do that, Colin.
As usual.
I know, as usual.
Layer
I did not
upon
even
layer.
Finish my chai.
I mean, that's kind of why what courts say now is there's the power, but we kind of don't want jurors to know about it.
Right. So it's generally they're not given the jury instruction. They don't really know they can do it. But at the end of the day, even without understanding it, this is like an actual mechanism or something they can do. Juries do reach sometimes, like I think it does happen where juries are like, you know, what justice calls for here is not what the state is going after.
Yeah. And there's the case that Mithla brought up a few weeks ago about the father.
Yeah.
And the older man who is with the underage daughter at the protective order. And we said, you know, we probably would nullify in that case.
Yeah. What's the answer, Colin, to this
case by case?
My answer is always to regulate. I mean, I like the idea of a nuanced jury instruction that's given that tells jurors what nullification is, kind of discusses the pros and cons as we did, and just puts it out there on the table. And so we understand both what it is and what it isn't.
Why doesn't the judge already explain that?
Because we don't want jurors to know, basically. Yeah. The judiciary is concerned that if jurors knew about this power, they would overuse it and it would dismantle the rule of law.
You know, I will say this. I feel like no amount of regulation on this, whether it's a ban or whether it's an explicit, you know, allowance for them to have this instruction or whatever, can actually really control a juror's, you know, the way they're going to behave and think. Even if let's say there's a ban, against this in some jurisdictions and jurors are not allowed to nullify. How can I, but if a juror says, listen, it didn't prove it to me beyond a reasonable doubt, that's what they're saying. We don't know. Maybe they that's the whole point of the jury. They have to individually determine whether or not the state made their case beyond reasonable doubt. And a juror can be like inside their head, yeah, this guy definitely did it, definitely guilty, but I'm not going to say that out loud. I'm going to say I don't believe it. You know, they didn't prove it to me. So I feel like at the end of the day, you can't really control the jury behavior, even with these rules. I don't know. But as a matter of public policy, I guess that's the question then. I don't think a ban makes sense to me. I think having something explicitly there makes more sense. And you still run the risk of, you know, like the example you gave us, but I would rather run that risk, I guess, in a way. But here's another thing that worries me. if there is a possibility of jury nullification, would that increase the chances of jury tampering then?
That's a good question.
Yeah. I mean,
there's also the question about Luigi Mangione, right? I mean, his trial, assuming it takes place, could be the most high profile example in history of possible jury nullification.
Good luck finding that jury. Yeah.
And I mean, the discussion we're having now is dealing with cases about someone chucking a sandwich at a customs officer. Mm. If the jury, despite the evidence pointing towards Luigi's guilt clearly beyond a reasonable doubt, nullifies in a murder case.
Yeah.
I mean, this discussion is going to, I mean, we're sort of setting the table because that discussion is
going to
become
much higher.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the stakes are much higher. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, Colin, what do you think? You think there should be some regulation?
I like what was proposed by this Tennessee representative.
Same.
And I mean, you'd have to think about how to tailor it, but I would like something where the court regulates it. They explain, look, here's the power. Here's historically some examples of bad uses and good uses. And okay, I mean, this power exists. We want you to try to respect the law where you can. But if you think this law is not morally justified, you are entitled to find the defendant not guilty.
I mean, I'm guessing this is the kind of thing like prosecutors would fight because it only hurts them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's never really going to hurt the defense.
Well, I guess that's okay. If it only hurts prosecutors, I'm all in. There's my answer.
Done and done. That was easy.
That was easy. All right. I'll go next. Ermita, you want to go next?
You can go. It doesn't matter.
I'll go next. So this is a case that was brought to, and I heard a little bit about this, brought to my attention actually in one of the questions we got for our Patreon bonus episode. If you're not on our Patreon, please jump on the Patreon. I think the $5 a month level, you get these bonus episodes as well. So, but we talked a little bit about it on there, but I want to talk about it on our weekly episode as well, because it tied into something else I was going to talk about. And this is about the trial of Gerhard, am I saying that right? Gerhard Koenig, who is a South African anesthesiologist living in Hawaii. And just a couple weeks ago, he was convicted of attempting to kill his wife. So I'm going to give you a little background about what was going on. Him and his wife, Ariel Koenig, were married in 2018. Gerhard had two kids from a previous marriage. And then together, Gerhard and Ariel had two sons. The family moved to Maui in 2023. And in late 2024, Ariel developed a close relationship with a married coworker who was a director at her company. Now, it was an emotional affair, and she admitted to it. Her husband had some... He had some suspicions, and so he would check her phone, and she would delete her messages, and she had exchanged flirty texts. Anyhow, she came clean to her husband eventually and said, look, there was never any physicality, no inappropriate pictures were ever shared. It was just as kind of flirting on text. Anyhow, he was still very, her husband was angry, upset, devastated, all this stuff. And Ariel apologized, and she said she wanted to save the marriage. It was a nothing burger basically, and like, you know, I want to stay with you. And so, you know, I mean, like, now other than this particular incident, I haven't seen anything in public reporting that they had any other marital issues. It seems like this was kind of the big thing, but also seemed like, well, they kind of moved on from it. They even were trying, you know, they did some therapy, got some, you know, like educational materials on how to heal from affairs, things like that. Now, as Ariel was trying to heal these wounds, 3 months after her husband discovered these messages, it's her birthday. It's her 36th birthday, and they take a trip from Maui to Oahu to celebrate her birthday. March 24th, 2025, about a year ago, they hiked the Palipuka Trail. And that's where, according to her testimony, she said she was trying to take a selfie near the edge of the cliff that they were on, and then her husband suddenly grabbed her by the upper arms and tried to push her off of the cliff. She dropped to the ground and, you know, to avoid being pushed off, which I think is a brilliant tactic. I've always told my kids, if somebody grabs you, like, just fall to the floor and become a sack of useless meat,
dead weight. Yeah, exactly.
So she does that. And then he straddles her, attempts to stab her with a syringe. This is all according to her testimony. And at that time, like, you know, Garrett Hart, she testifies that Garrett Hart said, you know, nobody's going to hear you out here. Nobody's going to save you. She's screaming, you know, whatever, hoping somebody hears. She fights back, bites him, all kinds of things, begs, you know, for the sake of their kids. And he goes, we don't need you anymore and all this stuff. Anyhow, then he's paused for a second and then's picked up rocks and starts like trying to hit her in the head with this rock. And that's when there were two women who heard her cries for help and showed up. And when they came upon the scene, he had in fact had a rock that he was like poised to hit her with. Now he takes off, is like gone in the mountains for like, I don't know, 8 hours or something, just disappears. But he at some point had a FaceTime with his son, and his son, not their joint son, but like his son from the previous marriage, named Emil. And Emil also testified in court. He goes, my dad FaceTimed me and said, Emil was like, what's on your shirt? Because there was like blood and like junk. And his father said, oh, that's Ari's blood, because I tried to kill her. So, you know, the son later testifies in court to this. Anyway, he also told his son that he was going to jump off the cliff himself after killing her. I mean, like, I guess this is how devastated he was from this emotional affair. And told Emil, take care of your younger brothers, blah, blah, blah. Anyhow, when he finally gets off the mountain after 8 hours, you know, he's arrested. He's charged with second-degree attempted murder. Bail set at $5 million. Now, the trial lasted 3 weeks, which is, I think, a long trial. Don't you think? I mean, like, the facts
given,
of the case.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
the
not
facts
a
are
question
simple.
Of, yeah,
yeah, it seems pretty straightforward.
Like that, yeah. Right. That's a long trial. I did not follow the trial, but I know, like, it's been big in the true crime space. Anyhow, the defense was like, this is a he said, she said thing. And Koenig's defense was like, Garrett Hart's defense was like, it was self-defense. She tried to hit me with a rock and I was defending myself. Anyway, he was eventually acquitted of the attempted murder, but he was convicted of the lesser charge of attempted manslaughter based on extreme mental or emotional disturbance. Okay. He's not sentenced yet. He can get up to 20 years in prison. And a lawyer has already said that we're going to appeal this, okay? But I want to first talk about what we talked about on the Patreon episode about this lesser charge of attempted manslaughter based on extreme mental and emotional disturbance and why this is so problematic. You tell us, Colin.
If we go modern times, going back to historically, the distinction between murder / attempted murder and voluntary manslaughter / attempted manslaughter is malice aforethought. And so murder, attempted murder, requires malice aforethought. Intent to kill, intent to inflict grievous bodily harm, depraved heart murder, which is extremely reckless indifference to the value of human life, and felony murder. You killed someone during the perpetration of a violent felony. Voluntary manslaughter says we can get rid of malice aforethought and downgrade it from murder to manslaughter if we have two things. Sufficient legal provocation and the killing is in the heat of passion, which Hawaii is talking about, this extreme emotional disturbance. Mm-hmm. One of the recognized categories is that can cause this duress is an affair, right? A spouse cheating on you.
Yeah, and the spouse gets triggered and loses their mind.
Right. And so that's the theory that Koenig pursued and succeeded on, was this emotional affair that my spouse was having flew me into such a fit of rage, we should get rid of malice aforethought and lower this to manslaughter. And of course, I think a lot of people looking at this in 2026 would say, well, wait, you're saying you can downgrade a murder to a manslaughter or attempted murder to attempted manslaughter because your spouse was, you know, talking to someone and that...
Do you know how many people would be dead in this country?
I mean... Yeah, it's disturbing to say the least. And I think that's why a lot of people looking at this case are saying, how in the world is this not attempted murder? I mean,
Something very archaic about like this thing, right? Like where, okay, you know what? You killed your wife or you killed your husband, but you were kind of upset about at them. I mean, the other thing is what I remember from law school is the example was a spouse walks into a bedroom and the spouse is in bed with somebody else. This is 3 months after he has discovered text. This is not at all at the same. So I don't know. how under, like, how long that emotional stress, like, you qualify for that, like, you know, kind of.
Yeah, it's not like he just found
loophole.
Out.
Right. No, I mean, that's the way it's supposed to operate with heat of passion is this event happens. And before you or a reasonable person would have cooled off for any period of time, you commit the crime. It's not to say that you can have a matter of months where this person is enraged the whole time. No, if they cooled off at any period of time, that's it. And there's no claim for manslaughter. That's the way it should be.
Is this charge, attempted manslaughter based on extreme mental... I mean, like, this to me seems clearly premeditated. He had a syringe with him.
That's what I was thinking.
What are you
just
doing
now
with a syringe? Okay.
Right.
This was. So I don't. I am shocked actually at this verdict. I mean, he can still get up to 20 years, but I just am really amazed. I mean, this is almost like a jury nullification as far as I'm concerned. And I don't know why they downgraded it like that. But anyhow, so this all happened. And I had already been looking at this article that I wanted to talk about this week about something, this phenomenon called Alpine divorce. And if you're not familiar with it, it's a concept that first kind of came up in a book that was written like 100-odd years ago. But I'll get back to that. But Alpine divorce is basically, I mean, it kind of sounds like really, I don't know, benign, but it's not, obviously. It's when women are left in really distressful situations in the wilderness by their partners. And, you know, like this guy, Gerd Hart, this is not the first time this has happened. In 2012, Harold Henthorne, he's a Colorado guy. He pushed his second wife, who was an eye doctor, off of a cliff in Rocky Mountain National Park when they were there to celebrate their 12th wedding anniversary once again. You know what I mean? It's like premeditated. He takes her out there on this pretense of their anniversary. His wife had insurance policies of $4.7 million. He was convicted of first degree murder, sentenced to life without parole. You know, I mean, there's so many times this has come up. But, you know, in 1893, there's a short story written by this writer, Robert Barr. And in that, He's the first one to kind of come up with this idea of the Alpine divorce, because in his novel, it's about a husband who plans to push his wife off of a cliff during an Alps vacation. And recently, The Guardian, just last month, published an article about Alpine divorce. And like the subtitle in very big letters was like, "Women are being abandoned by their partners on hiking trails. What's behind Alpine divorce?" I mean, first of all, we really need to examine what's behind Alpine divorce. I mean, but, you know, if you read this article, so many women who are interviewed for this talk about their experiences of going on a hike, going on some kind of, and like just being like abandoned, you know, because either there's an argument or they can't keep up, and then, and they are not necessarily equipped to go down. But also, generally, I'm not a hiker, but generally you do want to hike in pairs and stuff at least, mm-hmm. right? So you're safe. And, you know, a lot of these women shared their stories on social media, and so many other women like chimed in. Oh my God, it happened to me in this way. It happened to me in this way. And, you know, recently there was a case, where was it? Let me think. I think it was in, let me find it. Sorry. There was a case recently, in Austria. This guy who's identified as Thomas P., he left his girlfriend behind when they were going climbing in the Alps. And she clearly is, I mean, like she, they a storm hit. He gets a call from like the first responder type people saying, "We can bring a helicopter up there." He's like, "No, we're fine." He's like, I can take care of it. He leaves his girlfriend up there. To die, she dies of hypothermia. She dies from the cold, and he got a you know what he got. She died of exposure. He left her there and descended the mountain by himself. He got a 5-month suspended sentence for gross negligence.
What?
Manslaughter. Yeah. Interestingly enough, at the trial, he had a former girlfriend who testified that he had abandoned her on that same mountain 2 years earlier.
Let me add some law to this.
Okay.
While we're going, right? So,
oh yeah, we do that stuff here.
In American law, there's generally not a duty to act. To be convicted of a crime, you need a voluntary act, not an omission. But you do owe a duty towards your spouse. And so any dude out there who's thinking of taking their spouse up on a mountain and abandoning them, you can, under American law, be found guilty.
Is that not extended to, like, a relationship? Like,
well, and so that's the point I was going to get to, which is this classic case called Beardsley out of Michigan that says you don't owe a duty of care to a girlfriend. That involved a girlfriend overdosing and the boyfriend not helping her out. But there is a duty to act if you place someone else in a perilous position and you fail to remediate. And so, theoretically, in the U.S., if a boyfriend takes a girlfriend up on a mountain, like the Austria case, and leaves her there and doesn't attempt to remediate and abandons her, that would allow for criminal charges based upon her death against this boyfriend. Mm. I don't know about Austrian law.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, we've just come off a couple of different episodes talking about the Rape Academy and women not being safe in their homes with husbands they've been married to for decades. And now it's like, okay, now don't go anywhere dangerous with your significant, because it's, again, in this particular case, this is not a heat of the moment. Mm-mm. It seems like they're getting therapy. It seems like they have decided to recommit to the marriage. Ariel surely has. And they're going to celebrate her birthday. There are no circumstances that would, it's not like that she has any reason to fear, right? So look, my advice, take it legal or otherwise, or just as a woman, is always maybe go three people or four people at a time. Don't just go with one more person. Always have more people with you. I don't care if it's your spouse of years and decades, because you just, it's a scary world. And I have never, I mean, because I cannot see a circumstance in which the opposite would happen, because it wouldn't necessarily be as dangerous. And in many of these cases, the women who are talking about this on social media, they're like, we got out of there because other women hikers came across us. Other women came across us and helped us. And they're like, we're not going to leave you alone.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's crazy, right? Is so many of these cases, there's no indication. There's nothing
the scary
for the woman to say, no, let's not go hiking today because maybe they just came off of a fight or something. It's usually like birthdays and anniversaries that they're celebrating. Let's just go out and be nature in nature, honey, and take pictures. Yeah. And then it's, you know, an attempted murder or a successful murder.
I think it's a shocking result in this case. And I just feel like, once again, we have to ask Colin, why men? why are men? All right, I'm going to let you off the hook. All right, Mita, what you got for us this week?
Mine's not as bad.
Okay.
I actually wanted to talk about the Live Nation Ticketmaster trial.
I know nothing about it. Tell us about it.
Actually, one of our listeners also wanted to hear our take on it. So I figured I was kind of sort of following it. So let me go ahead and talk about it. I'm sure most of us have heard about Ticketmaster. We've probably used it and Live Nation. But for anyone who hasn't, Live Nation handles concert promos. They manage hundreds of venues and artists. And Ticketmaster is the ticketing subsidiary. The two companies merged back in 2010, and they formed Live Nation Entertainment. So recently there was an antitrust lawsuit that was filed against that company. And just in March of last month, they tried to settle for $280 million. But a coalition of over 34 states attorney generals, rejected the settlement, saying that's not going to fix the problem at hand, which is the company has control over the concert industry. And so basically what we're talking about is, you know, you've got artists, venues, promotions, and ticket prices. All categories fall under this one company.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like Ticketmaster or StubHub. I don't even know of another.
StubHub is a competitor, yeah. But they're so small comparatively.
Yeah.
And that's like the kind of the issue. The resale market tier, right?
Yeah.
And what's crazy is this all actually came to light during Taylor Swift's Eras Tour in 2022. And that was the catalyst for this entire trial. The company used its power, you know, they forced partners to use their services in other areas. And what ended up happening is the outrage from the Swifties forced the DOJ to take action in 2024 and file that lawsuit. And then just a couple weeks ago on the 15th, the jury found Live Nation Entertainment liable for operating an illegal monopoly. Mm. And obviously now the case moves on to a remedy phase. So, you know, we'll see what the judge says about punishments. The states are pushing for the company to be broken apart.
Right. Right.
Obviously any penalty fees and things like that. But what's nuts is in some of these cases, the Live Nation Entertainment has contracts with artists, let's say, or even venues. It's a 14-year contract in some cases.
Holy crap.
So they're really locking it in. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so, wow. You know, maybe the judge will say, you can't do more than 4 years or 1 year, whatever. So, and of course, Live Nation Entertainment is going to appeal this, which was expected. But, you know, we've obviously not only heard of this incident of a company monopolizing an industry. You know, we've got Google, we've got Apple, we have Amazon, we have everybody. But what's crazy is, you know, I guess the question to you guys, one of the questions is like, do you think that the monopolization of these companies and the lack of competition is harmful to customers and the economy? Or, you know, are we fine using Ticketmaster to go to our concert as we scroll through our social media accounts and buy everything we need on Amazon? And like, it's fine because we don't need all the options. It's kind of, you know, narrowed down because there's enough competition in all kinds of other products that we consume. And just in general, what are your thoughts about this? Because it's another landmark case, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think we have antitrust laws specifically because it is bad for public policy. It is bad for consumers. And the whole idea of letting the market decide that there's no decision to be made if there's no other competitors. So I think as a matter of principle, it makes sense to break them up. And, you know, I mean, look, my daughter went to that Taylor Swift, one of the concerts. I can't even tell. I was like, we could have taken a family vacation, you know, to Europe for the amount that was paid for those concert tickets. It's unconscionable to me. And I don't know if that would be true if there was competition. Yeah, I wonder about that. Colin, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I'm on the same page in terms of the verdict sounds right to me because their fingers were in so many pots for so many years. Right. And to Ravia's point, it raised prices. And then, you know, on my end, what I'm most concerned with is the possibly pending merger between Warner Brothers and Paramount.
Right.
Or initially was going to be with Netflix.
Yep.
Because that goes to the actual production of movies, right? This is on the back end of what's going to happen with the concerts and all that stuff, but at least the artists are making what they want. And so, yeah, I mean, I always am in favor of competition. And I think that we're seeing, unfortunately, the lack of competition, the increased monopolies. And so, I am kind of concerned. I'm happy to see at least one significant verdict on this front finding that this was in violation of antitrust laws.
Yeah, it's a pretty big deal.
Colin, what do you think is going to happen with that possible merger? Do you think, given this verdict, that they might rethink it? Because, of course, they're going to get sued.
Well, I mean, it's just from looking at the news, like Paramount is not doing well in terms of their stock and the people, you know, whether they're satisfied with the merger. And so I don't even know about the legality of it. I just know that the finances make sense. And so I don't know what's going to happen with this.
All right. Interesting. All right. Well, thank you to our listeners for bringing a couple of these cases to us. And we want to talk about what you want to talk about. There were actually a number of other cases that were always like flagged. I'm like, okay, at some point we're going to get around to it, but we can only do three cases an episode. So, but keep them coming. And again, if you want to listen to the bonus episode, we answer a lot of questions there and have great conversation there. So please sign up on our Patreon. I believe it is patreon.com/undisclosed. Is it undisclosed pod?
Undisclosed pod.
You'll find us. Close enough.
But thank you all for those of you that sent in the questions and comments and feedback. Appreciate it.
Yeah. All right, guys. Thank you so much. Have a good week. I'll see you next Tuesday then.
Bye-bye. Take care.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners. Before I roll through the credits, I've got a few quick notes. By now, most of you probably know about our Facebook community group. If you haven't joined yet, please go to facebook.com/groups/toward justice and answer 3 simple questions and you're in. But seriously, answer the questions because a bunch of you are still pending since you've only answered one or two. They're easy questions, I promise. In addition to engaging with us through the Facebook group, you can also leave us a voice note at speakpipe.com/undisclosed. We always check the messages, and so far, I think we've answered all of them. We also have a Patreon page with three different tiers of perks, the lowest one just being a dollar, which allows us to continue to do this work. Other tiers include bonus episodes, early access to merch, and even joining Rabia in a live true crime Zoom discussion. Just go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Now, onto the real credits. A huge shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Thank you to Patrick Cortez and Romero Marquez for our theme music. For anyone new here, you can engage with us online by going to Instagram or Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. We're also on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're a new or returning listener, you can always check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can find Rabia at RabiaSquared2 on Instagram and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you all for your continued support and for supporting all of our sponsors. Until next time.